Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. As the U.S. continues to move into the 21st century, we face a diverse array of traditional and asymmetrical threats to our security. Seemingly isolated events can have serious consequences thousands of miles away. The U.S. border is a nexus to a continuum of activities that impact our national security and our prosperity. Having a safe and secure border is critical. But so is safeguarding our economy by enabling lawful trade and travel. This balance between law enforcement and enhancing economic competitiveness requires a comprehensive understanding of all border threats and potential consequences. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, plays a critical role in doing just that. What are CBP's key strategic priorities? What is CBP doing to be more efficient and effective in meeting its mission? And how is CBP pursuing innovative security strategies? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Kevin McAleenan, Deputy Commissioner of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Kevin, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you.
Great to be back.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Don Finhagen. Don, welcome.
Thank you.
Kevin, would you provide us an overview of the history and evolving mission of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP? When was it created and how has its mission evolved to date?
Absolutely. U.S. Customs and Border Protection was created with the stand-up of the Department of Homeland Security on March 1st, 2003. And it's actually an idea that's quite a bit older. Seven times since the Woodrow Wilson administration, various Blue Ribbon commissions and panels of experts were brought together and talked about the need to unify the agencies responsible for border security and different aspects of border security, the immigration function, customs function, agriculture. Coast Guard was often joined in. And most recently, that came through in the Hart-Rudman Commission, which was the National Security Threats for the 21st Century, which was written and fairly presciently right before 9/11, predicted significant threats and recommended as one of the ideas to be better prepared to have a unified border security component. So that idea was what was behind the creation of U.S. Customs and Border Protection. And what CBP brings together is those inspection and interdiction functions that happen at the border and an extended border to help secure the flow of people and goods into the United States and to help secure our border between ports of entry. So the immigration and customs inspection functions, the agriculture inspection functions to ensure pests and diseases don't make it in to our economy, and very prominently, obviously, the role of patrolling between ports of entry on our land borders and in our coastal waterways, the customs waterways, a historical mission that goes back to the founding and Alexander Hamilton commissioning the Revenue Cutter Service. So it's quite a long history. In terms of the mission, you know, it's evolved along with the threats that we face in the modern world, as well as with the organizational improvements of having a unified approach to border security. So obviously, in a post-9/11 environment, we were created to address a new and global terrorist threat, and that remains our priority mission today, preventing terrorists and terrorist weapons from entering the country. But we've also seen the emergence of very strong and connected transnational criminal organizations, which are increasingly open to different business lines, whether it's moving narcotics, which is the traditional drug cartel, smuggling of people, trade-based money laundering, a whole set of threats that willing to make money in the black and gray markets across multiple potential industries. So our mission has had to evolve to account for that. And then just the tremendous growth that globalization has brought, both in travel and trade. Our missions had to evolve to be much more efficient. We have to employ risk management approaches to keep up with that vast flow. And we also have to make sure that we continue to enforce the trade and trade laws, things like intellectual property rights, things like import safety laws of products that could present a danger to consumers. All of those issues have become more complex since our creation just 13 years ago. So it's a large agency with a diverse and evolving mission.
Yeah, and I want to get right into it because you kind of hint at it a little bit with when you outline the mission and its evolution. Is what's the scale of operation within the organization? And what I'm trying to get at is how is it specifically organized? The size of its budget, the number of folks that work for you, and the geographical footprint.
Well, the scale is global. Obviously, we're concentrated in the continental United States, but we have a presence in all 50 states and in 40 countries around the world in 70 locations. 60,000 people, the largest law enforcement agency in the United States, over 45,000 uniformed armed personnel carrying out different functions, which I'll describe. $13 billion plus budget, one of the largest budgets in the civilian federal government because of that personnel commitment and the technology we need to utilize to carry out our multifaceted mission. But we're structured around four main operational components. The Office of Field Operations oversees our personnel at ports of entry around the United States and at pre-clearance locations in six countries around the world. That's about 28,000 folks. And these are our Customs and Border Protection officers, as well as our agriculture specialists and our trade specialists that deal with the transactional processing of trade entering the country and some teams to support them. We then have the Office of Border Patrol, the U.S. Border Patrol, which patrols the land border between ports of entry, both the Canadian and Mexican border, as well as working closely with our air marine operations, which is pretty interesting. We have the largest civilian air force in the world with over 200 aircraft and as well as 250 boats that patrol the coastal waters and riverine environments, both on the northern and southern border. So those are the three uniformed armed elements, field operations, border patrol, and air and marine. And then we have our Office of International Trade, which is also operational in the sense that it's responsible for the enforcement of trade laws and the facilitation of $4 trillion in trade crossing our border, but both imports, over $2 trillion in imports and almost, maybe this year we'll get close, at $2 trillion in exports to make sure that is safe, lawful, and secure. So very large scope of the organization. And we also, of course, to support that, have a tremendous information technology section that provides advanced analytics capabilities that manages vast amounts of data that go along with trade and travelers and the ability to sort them for risk. As well as the normal government management sections of human resources and finances and all the critical things that make the mission work. So it's a pretty broad organization, but it's really our whole effort is focused around those four main operational components.
I'm trying to get a sense, and I don't know if folks realize this. Could you give us a sense of how many miles of border are you covering? How many number of ports and how many people and items are we talking pass by in a given moment?
We have 330 official ports of entry, and as well as 15 pre-clearance locations in the six countries, and a number of user fee airports and other facilities that we oversee, bonded warehouses and foreign trade zones. So a number of operational areas that deal with the flow of people and goods. That flow right this year is expected to be over 365 million in terms of border crossers. That's about 120 million international air arrivals, and that's an area that's growing exponentially. Over 200 million land border crossings, both at the Canadian and Mexican border, very active areas for both daily and seasonal crossing, as well as our seaports. Almost 20,000 cruise passengers a year, as well as all the cargo vessels and the crews and captains that come in on those vessels, as well as pleasure boats. So, almost 400 million people that we deal with just coming in. We have responsibilities on the outbound as well that we can discuss. For the Office of Border Patrol, the U.S. Border Patrol, we've been apprehending the last 5 years between 300,000 and 500,000 people annually crossing between our ports of entry. So those are really significant numbers on a daily basis being interdicted between ports of entry, you know, crossing in illicit areas. So that's a high volume operation, both in the legal flows as well as the folks crossing between ports of entry, although those numbers are down significantly from the beginning of this century.
Hey, so can you talk to your specific responsibilities and duties as the Deputy Commissioner of CBP? How do you support the overall mission of the Department of Homeland Security?
Sure. I see it as really three essential roles. First, I'm the Chief Operating Officer for U.S. Customs and Border Protection. I have the responsibility of overseeing our options, of carrying out the guidance from our commissioner and making that happen operationally. So that's first and foremost. I also, in that role, have a significant responsibility on the administrative side. How do we do our planning, our programming, our budgeting, and our accountability mechanisms, and make sure that all of our enterprise services, our mission support functions, are aligned in supporting those operational missions? And then third, you mentioned the overall mission of the Department of Homeland Security. As the senior career official coming up in the organization, having time overseeing and working with each of our different diverse components, I have a significant responsibility in providing advice and recommendations, both policy and operational, to the secretary and deputy secretary and the various oversight offices of the Department of Homeland Security.
So, Kevin, what are your top, say, three management challenges or the top challenges you face, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
So I think I got to take on the challenges at the assistant commissioner level and now at the agency-wide level as deputy commissioner right at the time that federal budgets were becoming greatly constrained. The era where Homeland Security was an area that had significant funding growth every year was curtailed really in the 2011-2012 timeframe, and with sequestration became a significant challenge in terms of budget constraints. So I think number one is how to accomplish an increasing mission with that growth in trade and travel, that complexity of how both terrorist adversaries and transnational criminal organizations are trying to exploit our border during a time of fewer resources to accomplish that. So I think that's challenge one, and we can talk about different aspects of that. Challenge two has been, as the economy has improved, the ability to recruit, hire, and retain the kind of professionals we need to take on this complex mission in areas of the country that are often remote without a lot of infrastructure, that the hiring process has been very challenging as well. How do we find people that have very clean backgrounds that are trusted with this huge responsibility to determine who can be allowed in the country, to determine what goods are allowed in, to patrol remote areas of the border, often alone? You know, we really have to have a high trust and confidence in those kind of individuals. How do we find enough of them to work all over our vast nation and to take on some of these international opportunities we have, you know, even as there are lots of competitive agencies and certainly the private sector is offering a lot of interesting work in this increasing era of globalization. So that's been probably the second most significant challenge. And then third, and our Commissioner Gil Kerlikowske really honed in on this from the first day of his tenure, is this environment we face in law enforcement where there's an appropriate call for increasing integrity and transparency and accountability in the process of law enforcement. So how do we make sure that we have the right training, the right policies, the right equipment in place, not only to protect our personnel, but to make sure they can carry out their duties in the least impactful way possible on a mostly lawful public? Over 99% of the travelers we encounter are fully compliant with all laws. How do we make sure they're prepared for those rare situations where they need to take action when the vast majority of the folks they're encountering are compliant? And then how do we tell the public what's happened? How do we talk about it swiftly and as openly and accurately as possible when there is an incident where force had to be used, for instance, while taking down a drug smuggling operation across the border? That's been a real challenge in the current environment with the expectations of the American people, the appropriate expectations of accountability from their law enforcement protectors.
So I think we're really lucky to have you sitting in the role you're in. You bring a tremendous amount of expertise and experience from being around CBP for a long time, but what's really surprised you the most since taking your current role?
Coming into the role, I had served in senior positions, I've had the opportunity to be at the leadership table, unfortunately, on the same floor in the same building for 11 of the last 15 years. So I've seen a number of different leaders in that role. I've seen different challenges they confronted. So I think I was prepared in terms of the number and types of things I would face. I think the requirements to really look beyond the current challenge, the current month, the current budget year, and to try to plan strategically. That's much, at the deputy's level, that becomes much more imperative. Is what are we going to be facing in 3 to 4 years from now? And how do I help position the agency with the commissioner's guidance to have the resources we need, the innovative technologies we need, and the personnel we need for that environment? I think that surprised me is how urgent that feels. When you're running an operation, you're very connected with the day-to-day, the incidents happening out there on the border, responding to them, preparing for the next crisis, addressing it. But the chief operating officer level, you really want to be thinking into the future. And it's the thing that I think surprised me the most is how quickly that future comes, that growth. When you're sitting in 2009 at 89 million international air arrivals, and we're probably going to finish this fiscal year 16 at 120 million. When you're annualizing over 5% growth a year, 35% in 7 years, the future comes quickly. So I think that imperative to really be focused on that horizon has been, a challenge and an opportunity in the new role.
It's great that you mentioned that, because one of the funny things about it, and my next question is about effective leadership, is Admiral Allen, Thad Allen, used to talk about the tyranny of the present. Mm-hmm. And it seems like folks get stuck here in D.C. or when you're running anything that's huge, you get stuck in the present. You think that's you need to pay the bills, but you need to think about the future as well. And that gets to the next question around what makes an effective leader, Kevin. And perhaps you could illustrate for us how you have been an effective leader and who has influenced your leadership style.
So I'll come up with a couple of examples for this one, because I think it's maybe too hard to just pick one. Our first commissioner, Commissioner Robert Bonner, I think the lesson that he conveyed with crystal clarity was that you need to make sure you have strategic priorities and that you communicate them to your team. At that time, obviously, he started as the U.S. Customs Service Commissioner a few weeks after 9/11, September 21st, he was confirmed. He very clearly saw we needed to turn this venerable agency to a new priority mission, preventing terrorists and terrorist weapons from entering the country. Within a year, every officer in the field could cite that was what we were about, and that was our priority mission. And that cascaded through our resourcing, it cascaded through our IT priorities, and throughout the organization in an impactful and meaningful way. So I think an effective leader has to set very clear strategic priorities and tell the organization what they're intended to do, and how to structure accordingly. So that's one. Recently, in watching our Secretary Jay Johnson in his role, I've learned a lot about the need for a real leader to own the toughest issues personally. There are certain things that can't be delegated. You've heard President Obama talk about, if it gets to my desk, it's a tough one. It's a tough challenge. And so, watching Secretary Johnson work on the challenges regarding immigration enforcement and immigration law and policy, and really take personal ownership of those decisions, as tough as they are, as often as they disappoint different sections of our political environment, he does it with principle. He does it with attending to the legal requirements and responsibilities of his office. And he does it with great care to hear from the experts. I think that watching him own those issues and be responsible to fully understand all the parameters as he makes critical decisions has been a tremendous leadership lesson. And I think most directly and recently from Commissioner Kerlikowske, who's got 42 years of law enforcement experience. He's led police departments in three U.S. cities. He's been a beat cop. He was in the military before that. He's got a tremendous amount of experience he brings to the role. Watching him manage me and our senior operators with just the right formula of guidance But also freedom and trust has been really instructive for me. I tend to be pretty hands-on, especially when it comes to some of our operational issues. But I've actually tried to take a page from his book because we have tremendous operational leaders. Our executive assistant commissioner level for field operations or the chief of the Border Patrol. These are tremendous, highly experienced executives. And letting go a little bit of that operational detail and giving them that limited guidance, but a lot of trust, I think is something I've taken from my boss, Gil Kerlikowske. So I think those are three examples of what I think it takes to be an effective leader that I've taken from mentors and role models that I've been very fortunate to have in government service.
What is CBP's Vision and Strategy 2020? We will ask Kevin McAleena, Deputy Commissioner of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kevin McAleena, Deputy Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Also joining my conversation from IBM is Don Van Hagen. So, Kevin, I want to talk to you about the strategic, the Vision and Strategy 2020. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, outline the key strategic priorities for CBP, and just give us a sense of where you're going?
Happy to do that. The vision for 2020 highlights three of those areas with some clarity. Our first and foremost, our priority mission, the reason we were founded, our counterterrorism efforts, and that nexus that I talked about with transnational criminal organizations. Secondly, advancing comprehensive border security. Our role at the border, being the interdictor in trying to prevent dangerous people and things from entering the country, both at and between our ports of entry. How do we do it better? How do we become more effective? And also, how do we measure it and convey it effectively so that we can enable and support good policy and good law around our border security mission? And then third, the how do we foster and support that increasing trade and travel that's so critical to our economy? Many people don't realize that travel exports, the money that people bring from abroad to spend in the U.S. is actually the largest component of our export economy. And so we have taken on as a real priority mission the role to facilitate that and to try to create a world-class experience for an arriving traveler so that they want to come to the U.S. again. We do see that as our responsibility. So those three broad mission areas, I think, have been really central to a lot of the national focus, whether it's a security focus or a trade and economy focus. And that we've had a real critical role in pursuing those and in supporting our interagency partners, whether it's the FBI and the Intelligence Committee or DOD on the counterterrorism mission, whether it's the Department of Commerce or the Treasury on some of our trade work, whether it's Department of Transportation on travel. We have a real key role as a partner across many of these mission sets as well. So the vision and strategy for 2020 really ensconced those as this is what we do.
Yeah.
These are the things we do as an agency. The second thing that the vision and strategy does is it talks about how we do it. I talked a little bit about the need for integrity throughout our processes and the need for greater transparency and accountability that we can communicate. That's a principle that's core to our strategy. And then the need to have deepening integration both between CBP functions and between CBP and our interagency partners. And then thirdly, the imperative to innovate. If your resources are not going to increase and your mission is going to grow, you're either going to fail or you need to innovate to keep up. And that principle of innovation is also highlighted in our strategy. And I think it's reflected in a number of things that we're doing programmatically and operationally as well. So it creates a great foundation for us. It becomes the the navigation point for our resourcing planning process, which for your audience, they'll be interested in. We've been really trying to drive our policy and planning, the intelligence that feeds it, and then our decision-making on how do we spend that finite set of resources, how do we allocate it in the most effective way possible to accomplish our missions, and then how do we measure it, trying to drive each set of that process in a much more integrated fashion. We call it planning, programming, budgeting, and accountability. So it's been a really important document for us. We use it and refer to it routinely, and it's currently informing our fiscal year 17 priorities and how we plan for next year.
So, Kevin, as a follow-up, what are some of the most serious threats and critical trends that shape and inform CBP strategy?
You can't answer this question without starting with the situation we see in Syria and Iraq and the rise of the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, and really the challenge that poses strategically, not only to the United States, but to our allies in Europe, to our friends around the world, as so many of their citizens have gone to the conflict zone to participate with ISIS and other groups and potentially could return. And so from a U.S. Customs and Border Protection perspective, where our chief responsibility is to prevent those threats from coming to the United States, that manifests itself on an international aircraft. We've seen that there's a continued focus on commercial aviation as that spectacular attack vector. And as a border agency, we have a lot of information on travelers, and we're able to apply it now before people board an aircraft to depart for the United States in conjunction with our partners at the Transportation Security Administration. So we're able to use that information to make decisions on individuals that might present a risk before they board and make decisions and let carriers know that we don't think they should be boarding those aircraft today. And we do that thousands of times a year, dozens of times a day to significant impact. So that's the number one threat and our major focus in so many ways. It's also, I think, the major story globally is the increasing phenomena of irregular migration. So on our U.S. southern border, the story is that it's actually down significantly, especially for Mexico, with the improvement in the Mexican economy, the changes in the Mexican birth rate dropping dramatically. We don't have the same volume of flow, but we are getting people from further away more often. The Northern Triangle, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, we've seen children and families coming in large numbers due to the situations in their home countries. We've seen people from the Eastern Hemisphere taking a land border route through South and Central America to the U.S. border. So this is similar in a much smaller degree to what the Europeans are facing from both the Middle East and Afghanistan, as well as Africa. Migration flows through Turkey and Greece, as well as through Italy. So these present challenges. You want to make sure you sort out anyone who might present a threat in a larger irregular migration flow. But you also need to fulfill our humanitarian responsibilities of treating folks that are appropriately refugees or asylum seekers with great humanitarian care in the process. So those, I think, are the most critical trends, to use your term, that we're seeing. And then the third is the growth of trade at the same time there's an expectation for more significant enforcement, right? So there's an overcapacity in steel production in China as their infrastructure building slows. How do we prevent that from swamping U.S. markets and U.S. producers? You see that in several other key commodities as well. And we've gotten a very clear signal from the Congress with the Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act, which directs us to take greater efforts even than we already are in this area. Going back to those three core mission areas, which I described in our vision for 2020, those are both core of what we do, and some of which we've done since 1789, but also responsive to increasing challenges and trends globally.
Well, to maintain this continuous understanding of the dynamic and asymmetric global threat environment, you must enhance your ability to collect, analyze, and appropriately share the intelligence and information across the enterprise. Would you tell us a little bit more about how CBP Law Enforcement Intelligence Enterprise specifically drives the essential outcomes that it needs to deliver?
Absolutely. So a couple aspects to this. I'll start on the flow of lawful travelers and goods. You know, given our role at the border, our role to process that vast flow of travel and trade, we are in a position to collect appropriately significant amounts of information from air carriers, from cargo vessels, from different participants in the supply chain. So we have a really unique insight into the global travel cycle and the global supply chain. It's very difficult to move things around the world without somehow interacting with the U.S. economy. We're still such a significant player that gives us a lot of access and insight to data. And with the development of increasingly capable analytical tools, we're able to sort that to accomplish our age-old mission of risk management in a much more effective fashion to target our most significant threats. So CBP brings a ton of information to the table from the beginning on an intelligence or information perspective. Additionally, in our encounters with people that are trying to exploit our border for illicit purposes, the information from those arrests, the people crossing, what they brought with them, who they were connected to, how many times we've seen them, their biometrics provide a rich data source. And what we're experiencing is the power of combining these data, these different data sources that are intrinsic to our border security mission and our border regulatory missions, with information from other agencies and intelligence, classified intelligence. The power of that combination gives us a much better understanding, enables us to move beyond a sort of transactional process where we're looking at each individual traveler as an issue of first impression, to a counter-network approach, where we're looking for the organizations and the tendrils of illicit groups that are trying to exploit our border processes. That helps us focus on the real threats, and it helps us limit the impact to the vast majority of people that are lawful, that are crossing. So we bring a lot to that enterprise, and we've demonstrated that our data can be valuable to other agencies, and their data is hugely important when it's fused with our information. So the challenge is how to do that, both from an IT management perspective. We often surprise our information technology partners and our interagency partners with just the vast amount of data we have and some of its complexity. But also to make sure we do that in a way that attends assiduously to our privacy responsibilities, our compliance, and civil rights and civil liberties. So we've really improved our ability to take account of privacy impact from the beginning of a program. That's a commitment we've made, that we think about that as at every stage of development of how we use information. Because if we're not committing to that aspect of it, then the mission impact isn't worth it. So that's a key part of how we're approaching these problems. I would be remiss if I didn't mention a whole separate side of intelligence, which would be more on the geospatial or physical side from our what the military would call intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance (ISR) capabilities. The investments in border security over the last two administrations have given us much more visibility and situational awareness on the border, whether it's camera towers or ground sensors, our aviation assets, helicopters, fixed wings, and the type of electro-optical and infrared capabilities that they bring to the table, combined with our very high-level assets, our unmanned aerial vehicles, and their ability to be time on station above and an area of the border. All of that has vastly increased our situational awareness, and we've taken concerted efforts to bring that picture together so we get a real sense of what's coming at us on our land border and our coastal and maritime waters, as well as in the aviation environment.
I guess, is there one part of that picture that's really come together for you recently that, you know, a specific technology, something that's really become a game changer for you in that environment?
I do think that learning how to use our unmanned aerial vehicles and the kind of capability they can provide with advanced sensors gives us a much broader view of the border than even a modern helicopter with a good electro-optical camera or infrared radar can. And that's given us new opportunities to understand what's happening in an area of the border, new opportunities to follow and address a situation of a cross-border smuggling attempt from further away without alerting the criminals involved so that we can follow them to where they're going and have a broader impact on, again, that network that's involved. It's not just those two people crossing with a drug load. It's who are they doing it for and where are they delivering it to and combining that with our investigative partners.
The global supply chain is critical to our way of life. It relies upon a complex network that presents a lot of unique risks. Obviously, CBP deals with one of the biggest supply chains in the federal government, I would say. Can you elaborate a little bit on CBP's work to strengthen the security of the global supply chain, identify some of your key challenges in the area, maybe some partners you're working with? What do you think you can tell us about CBP's layered approach to securing the global supply chain?
I'd be happy to. And frankly, this is one of the areas that we moved most aggressively in right after 9/11, in the immediate years, with the concern over the potential of a terrorist group to exploit the global supply chain to introduce a weapon or something dangerous or illicit through the supply chain. And really that's founded on really another core principle of CBP, and that's public-private partnerships. We cannot do our job effectively without close engagement with industry and the key players in the global supply chain, from the major U.S. importers to the foreign manufacturers and everyone in between, whether it's a major express consignment operator like a FedEx or a UPS, down to a freight forwarder that specializes in a unique commodity and targeted audience. We want to be able to engage all of those elements to know who they are, to know how they interact, so that we have a comprehensive view of the security of the supply chain. So that partnership is manifested in a program called the Customs Trade Partnership Against Terrorism. It's over a decade old. It's got 10,000 members. Over 50% of import volume is now covered by CTPAT. It's an extensive effort where we have supply chain security specialists, people that we've trained and developed and cultivated, who are experts in how goods move around the globe, go work with a company on their supply chain, go visit their manufacturer's facilities, look at each entity that's a player in their supply chain, from their ocean carrier to their freight forwarder, to make sure those elements are secure as possible. That CTPAT and working together to secure that supply chain, because it's in the company's interest as well. No major U.S. importer wants to be the one that brought in a dangerous commodity into the U.S. Second is that data and information side, in collecting it more efficiently earlier in the process and analyzing it more effectively. A unfolding impressive development I would offer across government IT is U.S. Customs and Border Protection implementation of the single window concept in partnership with a number of our other departments and agencies, 47 of whom have a role in receiving information from industries moving goods across the border. And with the support of a presidential executive order, we are delivering this year and now have well over 99% of all international trade coming into the country. The data surrounding that is being submitted through a single window to the entire U.S. government. So say it's a pharmaceutical that's regulated by the FDA. Instead of U.S. Customs and Border Protection asking for that information once, FDA asking for it a separate time, a company submitting the data twice, it being given different responses on what to do with their cargo, it's now coming through a single window and an integrated response back to that player in the trade environment. So we think that's a huge advance. It's been extraordinarily complex, many years in development. We're delivering it this year on schedule with the president's executive order and are very proud of the partnership that's developed that. So with that information, how do we analyze it? How do we look for any threats from a security, a contraband, to a trade enforcement threat, as I described earlier? That's critical to the supply chain. And then how do we look at different submitters of information, whether their information lines up. How do you validate that trust? And I think this is an area where there's some really interesting developments out in Silicon Valley and in the private sector and in the banking industry around blockchains and how do you understand that the data is consistent across multiple parties in a non-trusted network. So we're very interested in how those could apply to trade data and strengthen our single window or maybe enable us to share single windows with other governments. That's the next step.
Yeah, I don't think folks realize CBP has such a unique role. It is both an enabler and a regulator of trade. So it's fascinating that you're looking at this way. It's great.
So I think we're just beginning to realize the power of that unique role. And I say, and first of all, our first commissioner saw it right away with the creation of the Customs Trade Partnership Against Terrorism. I didn't even mention our foreign deployments and our partnerships with foreign governments. But we're now applying a public-private partnership approach across so many of our mission areas. With the support of Congress, we've developed a reimbursable services agreement concept. If we can add value to a private sector or state and local government entity, and they think there's an economic benefit, a return on investment for paying for additional CBP services, we now have a legal mechanism to accept that and enter into agreements. We have several dozen now, and we have tremendous feedback from major airport authorities and land border consortiums that have come together to work with us so we can provide better service to their traveling public or to their trading public. So that's one method. Trying to keep up with the pace of technology development. I've heard you mentioned Commandant Allen. I've heard him describe it as a stern chase with the gap widening. and you know, the public has such growing expectations. If they can use their iPhone to order an Uber, to do all these things so conveniently, why can't government get their act together and keep up? So understanding that complexity, we're trying to create opportunities for the speed of business as opposed to the speed of government. I think the best example of that is our automated passport control kiosks. We went from a situation where in just 3 years ago, only 3% of travelers would interact with technology before encountering a CBP officer, just our global entry members at that point. By the way, global entry is quadrupled in the time.
So good.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I'll tell John Wagner, the spearheader of that program, that you like it. But we've gone from 3% to now 75% of air travelers are interacting with technology first. That saves 90 seconds to 2 minutes per traveler. And has enabled us to decrease wait times 3 years in a row despite 5% plus growth a year. And we did it because we let the private sector put the technology that they wanted in their terminal in, and we just told them the data that we needed to process their travelers more effectively. So that's the kind of public-private partnership we're working towards. We see that we have that opportunity and role as both a regulator and a partner and a facilitator that we can continue to expand. Pre-clearance and our opening to airports around the world that might want to pre-clear travelers before they travel to the U.S. Much more efficient way to travel instead of taking a transatlantic flight and then getting in a line with 350 people unloading from a 777 or 500 from an A380. Not ideal, unless you're a global entry member. Yeah, but if you're pre-cleared, you've done it at the natural pace of your arrival at a foreign airport, or with a group of 20 or 30 people that are transiting from your prior flight. So it's just a much more efficient way, and it's much more secure because it enables us to see people before they
sort
board.
Of expand out.
Absolutely,
security. Yeah, push the borders out. What is CBP doing to be more efficient and effective in meeting its mission? We will ask Kevin McAleenan, Deputy Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kevin McAleenan, Deputy Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Also joining my conversation from IBM is Don Finhagen.
So to promote organizational efficiencies, last fall the CBP commissioner announced realignment of the agency's headquarters structure to better support our personnel in fulfilling CBP's critical mission. How has this reorg helped transform CBP? What do you see the benefits from this reorganization, and what challenges you're working to address?
I think our realignment presents a great opportunity to become more efficient and effective across our organizational management. Students of organizational management might be shocked to learn that before this realignment became effective on June 15th of this year, the deputy commissioner and the commissioner together shared about 22 direct reports. A very broad span of control to include components with 28,000 people down to components with 10, all performing different responsibilities within CBP. And what that does is it creates a situation where there's a dilution of management focus and time where our leaders aren't getting the feedback and support that they necessarily needed or deserved, and where the span of control was simply not fully manageable. So we had to address that. That was a fundamental principle. But just reorganizing the chart and making it not 22 but 6 direct reports now to the deputy commissioner, wasn't going to achieve organizational benefits alone. So the second key principle of the realignment was really recognizing what we do and how we all need to align to support it. And those are the four operating components: the U.S. Border Patrol, the Office of Field Operations, Air and Marine, and the Office of International Trade. They were all assistant commissioners on the same par with 10 other peers at the time. But really, we took a page from the FBI or Immigration and Customs Enforcement. We have a concept of executive assistant directors, and in our case, assistant commissioners. And so we've made it clear that those four are our responsibility. That's what we're all doing. They oversee the men and women in the field that are interacting with travel and travelers and the trade community. They're interacting with folks crossing our border illegally. They're the ones we exist to support. So we aligned two other functions. We took our intelligence, our international affairs, our diplomatic arm, and the operational reporting, the operational requirements development, modeling and simulation, all the things that are really operationally focused that support those four main operators, and brought them together in an Office of Operations Support, led by an executive assistant commissioner. And I'm very excited for the potential for this group to provide added value to our operators across those functions. And we put a very senior leader in charge, former deputy chief of the Border Patrol, Ron Vitello, is going to lead that section. We then organized our what we're calling our enterprise services, all of the mission support functions, from the chief financial officer, the chief information officer, chief human capital officer, chief training officer, and of course, the chief acquisition executive. We wanted one organizing executive to be responsible for providing integrated business solutions to the operational elements. So that if our Office of Border Patrol has a complex need for a new technology and the training to go along with it, they have one integrated place to go to get a comprehensive solution. They don't have to say, okay, you're going to buy me the technology, and okay, I'll go over here to train it. Oh, and by the way, I have to ask for the money from a third place. It's a single enterprise services component that comes to work every day with the sole focus of doing what those four operators need. And so I think... if we get this right, and it's early, and we've created some governance mechanisms to deepen that integration, because it's one thing to structure it, it's another thing to make sure they're talking and working for one another the way we expect. But I think it's going to increase our leadership time to manage our core priorities. It's going to integrate services that are needed by the operators, and it's going to provide better intelligence and international engagement to our operational entities in a more integrated fashion. So I'm excited about it. I think it's pragmatic. It's not one of those changes that's so dramatic. We didn't put everybody in the same uniform or break down every organizational chain of command we had. We built on our strengths and we try to enhance them.
Well, you know, it's a great transition, building on your strengths and trying to enhance them. Regarding your hiring of frontline personnel, I mean, they're the strength, really, in there. Would you tell us more about your efforts to address some frontline challenges? But more importantly, Kevin, what are you doing to make the hiring process more efficient, more effective, and ensure that CBP is attracting the right talent?
Well, I think most fundamentally, we had to make it faster. if you're asking someone to consider a career with you, and it takes an average of over a year, 400 plus days to get an offer, you're going to lose your highest potential candidates. So that was our first commitment in the process. Our second commitment is we couldn't lower our standards. The role at the border is one that requires such high capability and such high integrity that we needed to maintain our standards. We also, very, very importantly, by law and by choice, we have a polygraph requirement for our frontline law enforcement officers. One of the challenges we faced is that there simply are not enough human beings who are federally certified polygraphers to maintain a 45,000 person workforce and increase hiring at the same time. So we've had to generate and train some new polygraphers to just keep up with that load. So that's been a fundamental effort. Secondly, we have these important steps in the process, and they were all done sequentially, and we would have a time gap between each step. So what we've done is move toward a concept of hiring hubs, borrowing from the private sector. And instead of sequentially managing the testing and the interview and the polygraph, we try to bring five or six steps together in a concerted 2 or 3 day process and get as many people through the pipeline as we can. And then we're much more responsive on the timeline. Our hiring time to hire has gone from over 400 days to 169. Which is much more consistent with a person's expectation of taking on a new career, and they can apply, you know, as they're leaving a previous job or as they're coming out of an educational institution. We have a lot of folks that have you know, college and advanced degrees interested in a career at CBP, and we're also looking at working with Congress on creating incentives to some of the remote and challenging areas that we need people to come. The communities there aren't large enough to support the enforcement presence we need, so we need to draw from around this great country and incentivize and get them interested in spending a few years in interesting parts of our country and helping secure our border. So really trying to incentivize some of those hard to fill locations. Without diminishing our commitment to that integrity, we're really trying to engineer a process that's much more responsive, much more efficient. Simple things like communicating via text, as people tend to do. Exactly. Sending them email updates as opposed to nobody's going to wait 6 months for a letter. So we've been able to take those steps into the modern era as well, and our chief human capital officer, Linda Jackson, is, I think, doing a tremendous job in pushing this forward. But we're going to have to take a much more aggressive approach on recruiting, make it a not just a collateral duty, but a fundamental responsibility of our uniform components and our mission support components to get out there in the community to talk about the excitement of these jobs. I was talking with the executive director of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and he was saying, "You got to be kidding me! We got people who great, talented graduates of colleges and universities in major cities that are just dying for jobs. Let me help you find them." And so we're doing a lot of outreach to organizations that have that reach across our country, where there are diverse and engaged populations ready to be part of a mission as compelling as CBP. So we're going to go find them with a revamped recruiting process that feeds that improved hiring process in an effective way.
So what advice would you give someone who's thinking about a career in public service?
I don't think there's a more compelling mission in law enforcement than securing U.S. borders. And I don't think there's a more interesting time or place to do it. People coming into a CBP career can chart their own path. They can work in 45 countries around the world. They can work in headquarters with cutting-edge data analytics. They can work in the intelligence profession. They can ride a horse or an ATV on our border. We have such tremendous opportunity. We have one of the best law firms, I think, in government in our chief counsel's office. We have a tremendous group of people doing great work. And they get to go home every day knowing they did something that matters. And I think that's maybe the most compelling reason to consider CBP. So I'd encourage them to look at CBP or the Department of Homeland Security more broadly as a great career path to develop them as professionals and to be very rewarding in the process.
Well, Kevin, once again, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule and joining us today. But more importantly, Don and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country. It's great to have you back. And folks have to understand, if with a leader like you, they might want to join up soon.
Thanks so much. Great to be here with you. Thanks for the time.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with Kevin McAleena, Deputy Commissioner of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. My co-host from IBM has been Don Finhagen. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan. Thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.